to do. So let's start here with me and you. Gonna take a little time. Let's see what we can find. Oh, come on, walk with me, talk with me, tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. And I want to say, boy, it's been quite a week as I've wrapped up sort of the celebrating of my birthday on Saturday the 26th. And for those of you who don't know, I just turned 50. I still can't believe I've turned 50. It's kind of a weird feeling. I don't actually sit down there looking in the mirror and try to find where I look 50. But it is still a very strange sensation to think that, you know, there are people who have attitudes and perspectives and a lot of energy around age. And of course, I've heard this comedian Lewis Black talking about how people say that the 80 is the new 60, and the 60 is the new 40, and 50 is the new 30. And he says, no, that's why they gave them numbers, because that's what they are. But it doesn't mean much if you don't feel that way. I have to say that as I approached and still feel this way, I feel like I'm 17, 18 years old. My physical body may not be able to do those kinds of things that the 50-year-old physical body can do. But that doesn't mean that there aren't other ways, and I've always believed that there are other ways of accomplishing whatever it is that you want to do. That's a part of the reason for this program. Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices, knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific Time, streaming live on the internet at richarddugan.com, and we archive these programs as well. And what we try to do is bring you people who are doing just that, trying to work with what we have, create what we want so that we can build a better world, maybe a safer world, a more beautiful world, a more loving world, a world where we can feel comfortable about even exchanging ideas. I mean, even that's become somewhat precarious because there's so much energy tied up in different topics and subjects. Well, today we're going to talk about the energy of change in our culture from the Institute for Cultural Change with the director, Lori Pye. And Lori, I want to thank you so much for joining our program today.
You're welcome, Richard. Thank you, and welcome to the fifth decade of your life.
Well, it is quite exciting, I have to say, and I'm thrilled that we are. It's funny. Someone made the comment to me that I'm entering the final quarter of my life, and I'm thinking, what? No. At the very least, it's either the second third or the second half. I used to say in my 30s that I was going to outlive my great grandmother, who lived to be 100. And as she got older into her 80s and 90s and so forth, I thought, you know, you're making this really hard. But I've been told that it only gets better from here, and I believe that. I've felt that even from before I even came close to this supposed landmark. And it is rather interesting. I've started to work on our property doing different things, and I feel like a kid. I'm careful. You know, I don't want to injure myself.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I want to get out there and do things. And
yeah.
I know that's what we all want to do. We want to get out there and do things. We want to get out there and make changes. I've often said this, Lori, that if the ways in which we live today worked, our civilization would be much further along. And the reality is, all we have to do is look around. We are not. Ergo, from my perspective, and yes, this is subjective, the ways in which we are living today don't work, and we need to find new ones. That's part of what Institute for Cultural Change is about, is it not?
That's correct. And, you know, you instantly bring up a really important component of what we're trying to do. The way that we live today is not working for several reasons, and one is because a lot of the way that we're living today is based on very outmoded type of mythologies. Even some of the things that we think about and how we approach each other in the world is based on 17th or 18th century type of philosophies or religion or theologies or psychologies. And so, of course, it's not working in a much different, very fast-paced 21st century.
Tell me a little bit about the Institute for Cultural Change. How and why was it started?
Well, I started it in 2008, and the real impetus behind it was to try to give people tools for understanding how to make change, because a lot of people talk about change, and we need to make change, and let's embrace change, and we need change, blah, 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 but that's very big statement. How do we do that? How do we get from point A to point B? And so it's not just so simple to, you know, do something different in a day, because that doesn't have necessarily a sticky value to it. You may do something different in one day. You may change a practice or a behavior in one day, but the very next day you go back to it. So what the Institute for Cultural Change seeks to do is really find ways to help and promote individual and cultural evolution, and through educational programs, through annual conferences and workshops, and we hope to try to foster and nurture curiosity, imagination, certainly personal reflection, and a cross-cultural dialogue, so that we really understand how we as humans can develop empathy and perhaps change our way of looking at ourselves, each other, and the natural world as the other.
Well, as we talk here on this program on a Saturday afternoon, we are in the midst of celebrating what many look at as the independence of the United States of the Americas in 1776 with the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of the United States, Revolutionary War, and the list of historical reference points continues. And maybe in one sense, that's what you're wanting, is sort of a revolution as well, and people who are in support of this cultural change are wanting a revolution that will take us to a new level, a new place of living, and we're going to find out more about that as we continue talking with Director of the Institute for Cultural Change, Lori Pye. I'm Richard Dugan, and you're listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You can't go on falling back, a flooding. Keeping all that fear inside. I understand how trouble haunts you. It haunts me too. Yes, and I do know how you feel. Oh, come on, walk with me. Talk with me.
Tell me your story. New paradigms for a new world, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and my guest is Lori Pye, director of the Institute for Cultural Change. And Lori, I'm taking it that that is also the website address, instituteforculturalchange.org. Is it .org?
.org, correct.
Okay. People can go there, find out what you're all about, what the Institute is all about. And you've only been around for a couple of years, a short time, to have taken on what some would consider a monumental task. And I've heard it said that when there is a monumental task before us, whether it's, if I can use this analogy, cleaning up the Gulf of Mexico, cleaning up the, I've heard it referred to as the gyro out in the Pacific, and I hear there's one forming in the Atlantic, you don't try to fix it all at once. You have to take it in little increments, bits and pieces at a time, and eventually, over the course of time, you'll have your solution. And I know that that is part of what you folks are about, inner evolution for outer change. And that inner evolution is also a step-by-step process, isn't it?
It is, and it really does have to start with some sort of reflection. You have to be able to engage in a self-reflective activity in order to be able to see what your behavior patterns are. But inner evolution, outer change also has more meanings than just, you know, something that seems sort of simple. It also means as we change the brain, we change culture, and as culture changes, it changes the brain. So there's this is very important critical cyclical activity that we can participate in and engage in so that we can almost co-participate in our species evolution rather than just sort of being subjected to, which way the wind blows. And I think that is very, very important because it taps into some of these enduring questions that we've always asked. Who are we? You know, what is our role here on this planet? What are we to do with this life? And I got to say, Richard, I can't think of anything more important than becoming conscious.
And what do you mean by conscious?
What I mean by being conscious, this is a lot of what we talk about in mythology or depth psychology or even in the neurosciences, it's a heightened sensitivity to everything going on in not only in your body, but in your environment and in the natural world around you, so that the sensitivities that you're feeling or seeing or smelling or witnessing, you're able to process psychologically and make sense of and make meaning of. And therefore, you're deepening your understanding of not only who you are, but who you are in the world in which you live in.
I know that sometimes that can really be difficult for some of us because we're not sure what world we live in because of a lot of the upheaval and the turmoil and what apparently seems as chaos to many people, that we're having difficulty even getting a handle on that.
Well, again, turn it around. Don't try to get a handle so much on the chaos of the world, but try to get a handle on your own internal chaos first, because we do project much more of our internal landscape onto the natural world. So when the world seems completely out of control and chaotic, it very much could be that there's a lot of internal upheaval going on inside of us. So that gets projected outward. And that, of course, is where we try to have workshops and conferences that teach and give people skills and tools to engage in a reflective activity and understand that this is a creative process, that consciousness is a creative process. It doesn't mean it's easy, because change is never easy. That's why we don't do it. We try to fight it tooth and nail and refuse to either make change or try to deny or compensate for having to make change. And so that takes us back to your very first sentence. Well, it's a difficult world we live in. Yes, but who makes the world? Human beings, in part. In part, we make the world. So it's very true that we can create the world that we want, but everyone has to be able to engage in some sort of psychological life.
I find it fascinating to reflect, as you were sharing there, about this process back in Phoenix in one of the sequences or cycles of my career. I was very much aware that when the atmosphere around the radio station began to calm, things began to sort of fall into place, we fell into sort of a routine, change was imminent. And so I began to really observe that. I began to really watch for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would even tell people, I said, you know, it's getting just a little too comfortable. We're really getting into our cycle, and we're doing great. We're doing great work, and we're having a lot of fun and so forth. Change is coming. I can feel it, because that's what happens when this nice, even flow comes along.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't say that I've observed that here. I think it's different in this phase of my life, where it's almost as though, all right, that was then, this is now, and there's a new observation to take over. And change is as the old saying goes, is the only constant in the universe.
It's inevitable.
Yeah.
One of the courses that we teach at the Institute for Cultural Change, it's actually a 6-month training that I teach in eco-psychology, and which is a new discipline that has budded out of not only the environmental sciences but the humanities as well. So the training in eco-psychology looks at change through an ecological lens, and we know that all systems in the natural world of which we two are a part have to change. If you think of a pond, if that pond doesn't change, it becomes stagnant, and it will eventually die.
Mm-hmm.
Or a riverbed, or even parts of the ocean, the coral reef, great forests. All systems have to change. Well, we too are a system. We're a very complicated, complex human system. So if we do not undergo change, then we undergo ramifications that happen or consequences that happen from not changing. And that can lead to ill health. It can lead to physical ill health. It can lead to unhappiness. And certainly we see it with depression and all kinds of, psychological ailments. And so that to me is extremely important. If we go back again to one of those enduring questions is, how are we to live our life? What is our purpose on this planet? I don't think it's to be, a depressive, suicidal, homicidal, eco-suicidal species.
I've been also intrigued by some of the new programming on some of the stations dealing with these kinds of questions that we're bringing up.
Mm-hmm.
Morgan Freeman has a new one regarding the wormhole, and that's just the title of the program, but he's asking some very intriguing questions about the Big Bang and the beginning of the universe and those kinds of things. And when you raise the question of eco-psychology, one of the thoughts that came to mind was it seems as though 100 or 200 years ago or along those lines, it wasn't eco-psychology, it was economic psychology. It's like, okay, how can we get the biggest bang for the buck? How can we pay as cheaply as possible? How can we make as much money as we can? It seems as though people are starting to make a shift and beginning to realize that that's not what is going to turn the tide, if you will, that we have to expand our thinking beyond that. That isn't the solution.
Mm-hmm.
That for you and me to go out and be able to make enough money to sustain our lives, pay our rent, it almost goes along the lines with what you said about the kind of life that we're living now, the suicidal, homicidal, et cetera, kind of a depressive life, which unfortunately there are a lot of people living that life today.
Yeah, and probably because we're having to now look at the shadow side of capitalism that not only just this country but many countries around the world have engaged in, and any system can only go so long without change, and we've been engaged in a very fast-moving, high-powered capitalism in this country for probably 40, 50 years, or 30, 40 years for sure. Well, the shadow side of that is now coming out, that has harbored greed and self-serving motives for business practices and banking practices and even, governmental policies that have come down. So we're having to endure that now, but this is a change that is hurting all of us. It's very painful, but yet we need this type of change. We could not continue in that capitalistic type of system and have any type of sustainable future. And again, this is sort of the end point here, is that how do we develop a sustainable psychology so that we can develop a sustainable culture?
What does sustainable really mean? I've heard a lot of different definitions, and I have to wonder if nature is sustainable by whatever the definition is that man is using.
Well, sustainable, at its most reductionist form, but simple to understand, basically means something that is maintained over a long period of time. So if we think about our own inner life, our own psychology, do we have diversity? Is there energy flow? Is there creativity? Is there curiosity? Do we have a sense of imagination about ourselves or others or the world that we live in? And I don't mean a negative response to everything, but a real curiosity and imagination about this incredible world that we live in. And that needs to start with our own internal psychological world. And as drab or as dull as that is probably going to be as drab and as dull as you think the world is, because that's the lens in which you see the world. So that's why I always take it back to, well, what's going on with me? What's going on with me internally? if I'm seeing something in a very destructive way, is there something going on in me that needs to be broken down changed and altered so that new life, a new idea, a new thought, a new image can come forth from that? It's the same thing that happens in nature, happens in us. Things, leaves are shed off the trees, animals die, they break down, they rot, they decompose, they produce organic material that goes into the soil, which produces new life. And it's the same thing with us, but the elements are a little bit different. You know, old mythologies, old family stories, secrets, family heresies, all these mythologies can also be broken down. You can allow them to decompose, to rot, to change into new life, a new way of doing things, a new way of seeing your family or your loved one or your potential partner, or a new way of looking at the world. But old things have to die, and that takes us back to a very interesting mythological tenet that creativity comes from destruction. And I think you were a part of the program that we did with Elizabeth Stewart where we talked about creativity coming from destruction. And again, you brought up something about chaos. Well, organization also potentially can come out of chaos. But these are states that are very hard for the human being to endure. We like fast fixes, quick fixes, a pill for everything. We don't like to suffer. So, but change does. There is a component to change that is a suffering. And so we learn a great deal about ourselves if we allow something to break down. It rots, it stinks for a while, we're not pleasant, we're not happy. Things seem like they're going to hell in a handbag. But on the other side of that, we can change a very destructive behavior. And when we do that, then we're happier. We know something about ourselves that we didn't know before. That's becoming conscious. And we take that human being and we put that consciousness into the collective or into the culture. And that changes the culture.
And that's what we're about, changing the culture. The reality, though, is some people say, well, how dare you change the culture? The reality is, though, that you can't do anything but change the culture.
No, of course. I mean, someone who makes a statement like that is basically like a bird with their head buried in the sand and would refuse to change anything about themselves as well. But even physiologically, biologically, we change. You just turned 50. That's a big change. You didn't have a choice in that. We age, you know. So to say how dare you change culture is a remark that we do hear in the media now. People don't want to change. They're resisting change left and right. But there's many, many reasons for that we would never have time to cover in this show. But that kind of statement is indicative of someone who's got their heels buried in the sand and saying, no, I don't want to change, therefore I don't want my world around me to change.
I know that there are those who would like to go back to a different time that was better, quote-unquote better. A lot of people, when I was working in Phoenix in the 80s and 90s, they said that the era of the 50s was the great era, that's where they want to go back to, when values were values and so forth and so on. And again, the reality is that you almost are taken, I'm not sure if this is quite the right way to phrase this, but you're almost taken kicking and screaming into change. Again, that's bottom line, that's just what happens.
Yeah, all right.
So are there, now you've mentioned a course in particular, but I know that you have other things going on with the Institute. Is there a course that can help us to better handle change when it comes, or is there a course that can teach us to reach out and embrace and maybe even say, I want change, I love it, bring it on, there is no tomorrow, bring on the change today. Is there a way for us to get to that place?
Well, no.
Oh, wow.
Because again, that's as much as a romantic fantasy as saying I want to go back to another time or era, because anyone who stands there and says, hey, I love change, I can do it, bring it on, let's go, really has no idea then what they're in for. And that would be a very irresponsible, naive position to place anyone in. So, but anyway, let me answer your question about programming. Mm-hmm. We just concluded a phenomenal conference that, again, I know that you were a part of the shows around and helping advertise that conference here in Ojai. And that was the aesthetic nature of change. And that was a three-day event that we did look at, you know, how to really start to work with interchange so that we can make change in our psychology, we can make change in our life, we can make change in our relationships, in our home life, in our family systems, and, of course, then in our communities. And so that was a significant event. That was just last month. We will do something every year around the idea of change, but there's also other conferences that are coming up in 2011. One will be looking at ecology and psychology and how we can use images and metaphors from the natural world to better understand ourselves and how these systems change. So that's a really beautiful way of looking at changes through nature, because it's not something that is filled with moralistic judgments. Change just happens, and there's always reasons for it, and we can see those. And that helps give us an image for how to change psychologically. So that will be coming up in 2011. We're putting that together now.
That's very cool.
But we're also putting together a series of workshops that we will be doing with Ernest and Catherine Rossi, who were at the conference on change. And the Rossis are pioneers in the neurosciences of how the brain actually can grow and change patterning. And so I'm very excited to be putting together a series of workshops with them so that anyone can come in and be taken through tools and skills and exercises and, you know, hands-on practical things we can do to start to engage in our own self-reflection and how we make change in the brain. Because our behavior, remember, is dictated by the patterns in the brain.
Yes.
Those can change. We know now that the brain is one of the most plastic organs that we have, and it's capable of huge amounts of change. And it's just that we don't do it. We don't use it. We don't repattern it. We get into a comfort zone, and we prefer the destructive behaviors over having to go through what it would mean to change those into more productive behaviors. But it's possible, and for those people who are interested or curious about it, just sort of stay tuned on the website. We just had a meeting about that yesterday. So those series of workshops will be coming out in 2011.
InstituteForCulturalChange.org is the website. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. My guest is the director of the InstituteForCulturalChange.org, Lori Pye, and we are talking about change. And I want to throw something at you that is rather intriguing to me, because I have a feeling this might be, correct me if I'm wrong, but this seems like it's the core issue or point that creates the most difficulty with change: attachment. Tell me about change and attachment.
Yeah. Well, we'd have to kind of look at the word attachment, because psychologically, there's attachment theories. And so I think that's probably not what you're asking. I think you're asking simply just human attachment to people, places, and things.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah, so, because people and places and things are constantly moving and changing in our lives. I moved from Phoenix to Santa Barbara, left my family behind, and now I'm not there to socialize with them or the business partners or the home that we lived in, a thing which we created and developed, and it was a beautiful place. And if we could have brought it with us, we would have, but couldn't do it, so we had to change living accommodations. And so forth and so on. So, yeah, it's persons, places, and things that we get attached to.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we get attached to things. It's part of the things that gives beauty and meaning to our life. But if the attachment turns into something concretized or cements you into something that you can't move from, then you could potentially look at that to see, is this hindering my growth, or is it actually providing stability? It can go both ways. It's not an either-or type of thing, but you know, the importance of what you bring up, where most of our attachment problems are with people.
Yeah.
So, you know, learning to develop discernment and discrimination and understand our own psychology better allows us to make better decisions around the people that we bring into our lives. And before that, you know, we're basically experimenting, and sometimes we bring people into our lives that cause a great deal of destruction and disaster and heartbreak and turmoil. And so how do we learn from that? How do we can't just blame it all on the other person. There's a co-participation in that. So that's, again, going back to learning who you are. It's one of the great things the Greek sages said, you know, who are you? And to know thyself is really what we're talking about here. To know thyself is not so simple, though. It's not just to know a few things about you, your favorite color, what you like to eat, and where you like to go. That's not really knowing yourself. That's just knowing, you know, kind of personal surface things. But to know thyself was what really means, who are you in the most distressing situation? Who are you when your life turns upside down? Who are you when an earthquake hits your heart? Yeah.
Who was it that said, I could live with you for a lifetime and know virtually nothing about you? I could play a game with you for an hour and know everything about you.
Yeah, that's very true. It's hard to imagine that you would live with someone that long and not know them. That would be, to me, it sounds like two closed systems, you know, coexisting, where there's no questioning, no curiosity, no, you know, intrigue about the other. So I find that, you know, difficult. But certainly it happens if you think about, you know, some of the more difficult things that happens in culture, where someone goes in and shoots up a school or a post center or causes destruction in a community, and everyone in the community, wow, I would have never thought this guy did that. He was such a nice guy, or she was such a nice person. You know, we lived next door to him for 30 years. Well, did you ever talk to him? Did you ever ask him any questions? Did you ever, you know, engage in any kind of deeper conversation with him?
So where are you coming from? You started the Institute for Cultural Change in 2008. But where were you before all of this, and what was the catalyst that propelled you in this direction?
Well, change, of course.
Dumb question?
No, that's an excellent question. I think you and I have actually talked about this before, but, you know, my educational background is, I have my bachelor's is in sciences, so of course I that's where I gravitate to the ecology environment. And I spent many years as director for marine conservation organizations and trying to protect our wildlife and our oceans. And while I was doing that, I was finishing up my master's in mythological studies and depth psychology. And so I basically blended my interests and my passions into, you know, a mythological, ecological, psychological approach to my life. And so I teach eco-psychology not only through the Institute, but at UCSB, and I teach a course at Antioch in Santa Barbara and Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. So, but where I, you know, come from as far as starting the organization was a huge upwelling in my life, you know, leaving one organization that I had been with for a number of years sort of overnight in a very surprising manner. And I was sitting at my table one night thinking, okay, you know, what is it I really want to do? And I got up and went to my computer, got a tax ID number, and downloaded the paperwork for a nonprofit, and, you know, off you go.
But what was the impetus in regards to Lori Pies being involved in a bigger picture than just herself?
It was the bigger picture. What I had to ask myself a question after the organization I was with before sort of dissolved overnight, and I truly had put my life in that organization. I loved everything I did with it, and I thought that I would work there the rest of my life and promote the ideas of mythology and depth psychology, and that didn't happen. And so I was at a crossroads myself with you know, no income, no job, no sense of vocational identity. I certainly had my own identity, but a vocational identity is equally important. And so that was sort of swept away very quickly, and I just had to bounce back. I have a sense of resiliency in my own life, and so what would I most want to do now that everything is gone, now the landscape has been swept clear? Okay, what do you want to do? And it was, how can I bring tools to the community to engage in a consciousness process? How can I do my part with the 50 years I have left, with the half-life that I potentially have left, to help bring consciousness, you know, into the world?
Yeah.
And that starts with my own consciousness process and my own deep inner work. But, you know, the people that work with me in this organization and participate in these conferences have the same vision and the same heartfelt desires. How do we make this species, how can we create a more conscious species? How can we participate in that change rather than letting change whip us around? You know, the Greeks had a wonderful way of looking at this, and they felt that if you knew thyself, if you took the time to really to understand who you were and to look deeper than just beyond, you know, the skin and the bones, but look into the heart, look into the soul. If you engage in a process of knowing thyself, you co-participated in your destiny. If you didn't, if you wanted to remain unconscious, ignorant of things around you, uneducated, your head buried in the sand, then the fates would determine your life.
Hmm.
And the latter, the fates determine your life, is not always a very pretty picture.
Wow. Yeah, fate, leaving it up to fate is not necessarily the best solution. We're talking with Lori Pye. She is the director of the Institute for Cultural Change here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And when we talk about the culture, people refer to America, the United States, as multicultural. And then you have all of the different nations of the world have different cultures. And even within those nations, there are different cultures. Can we better define what we mean by culture in terms of cultural change?
Well, I mean, culture is a huge word, you're right. And in terms of cultural change, we're not looking at just Western culture or Eastern culture or, you know, particular races or denominations or tribes or indigenous populations. We're looking at really the human race, but we do gravitate to particular cultures, and every culture has its way of dealing with its own internal psychology, the people, and of course the psychology of the culture. For example, the psychology of the Western culture is different than the psychology of the Eastern culture. We approach things differently. But as far as culture, how we look at culture with the Institute here, it really goes into our vision statement, and that's that we are hoping to create and connect a very impassioned global culture, a global community that's committed to altering how we humans might relate to ourselves, how we might relate to each other, and how we might relate to the natural world less destructively, to discover ways, you know, to interact with each other less violently, in a less racist and sexist ways, and really towards augmenting conscious change in, as you say, a very challenging world. So we're looking at really how do we work with ourselves and each other as human beings.
Yeah. I heard somebody say once that they had observed, for example, especially with the current crises we have around the world, they had observed and tried to get a handle on, like, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and what their beef was with the Western world, you know. And and they sort of explained what that was, what the beef was. And this person that they were talking with said, okay, well, I may not agree with their methods, but they have a point. They have a point in terms of their dislike of Western culture, because it's so hedonistic, it's so materialistic, it's so capitalistic, and so forth. It's so self-centered. And so this person said, well, I can kind of see their point. I don't agree with their methods. Don't get me wrong, they said, but I see their point. There are people who are like this, these particular groups. They're affecting cultural change, aren't they?
Oh, of course. Of course.
How
but,
do we
but
go?
In a, you know, from, you know, in many ways, we all affect cultural change because, again, we're putting our individual psyches into the collective. We're putting our individual belief systems into the collective. And one of the tenets of eco-psychology is that everything is connected.
Yeah.
Every system is interconnected and interdependent on each other. So I don't see that there's a difference in the systems of the natural world than in human systems. So, of course, when something happens, a bomb blows up in Afghanistan or a particular tribe commits genocide in the Sudan or, you know, a woman is raped in another country. We feel that around the world. That's human empathy. That's what we are trying to cultivate is an empathic civilization, which, of course, Jeffrey Rifkin has written an incredible book about and traces our human history up to present day, looking at how we are trying to develop empathy. But, you know, many people have written tons of books on the reasons why and why this culture or that culture thinks this way or does this. And, of course, it's all economics, it's all political, it's all psychological, it's all religious. It's all of these things. It's a huge, complex, complicated, ever-evolving, ever-changing system. That doesn't mean when I say evolving that it's progressive, that it may be moving in a more empathic way. Some systems, you know, can move in a very unempathic way, a very destructive way. And so although we're all connected, it doesn't mean that there's not really dangerous and destructive connectivities or systems operating within systems within systems within systems that potentially can destroy the whole. So that's why it's very important to engage in our own psychological work so that we're aware of our own shadow. We're aware of where we carry our inner destructiveness, where we carry our inner judgments and our inner racism, our inner sexism, our inner hatreds, because we do. We do.
Yeah.
And that's not to say there's a judgment with that, Richard.
It's just what is.
If we get into a judgment of ourselves, we stop the process.
Yeah.
We have to know this is part of being human, but by golly, we have a way of dealing with it. We can actually work with these things that mm-hmm. cause destruction. We don't have to say, well, I'm a human being, so I'm going to, you know, I kill people. No, it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah. What does have to be at this particular point in time is a break, and we'll come back and talk more about all of this as we continue talking with Laurie Pye, director of the Institute for Cultural Change.org. Get more information at that location and check out the various programs and check out our website, richarddugan.com. We're linked to Laurie's website as well. Stay tuned. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World.
If we leave here today, we could be 1,000 miles away. Take to that road, see how far it goes, and on that great ocean road, all the country's in our bones, all the trouble that you know empties out as you go.
Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. What are those dreams for? A brighter tomorrow? How about a brighter today? Let's start thinking about this kind of thing in the present tense, and we can kind of see where we're going. I've even heard it said, Laurie Pye is my guest. She's the director of the Institute for Cultural Change. I've even heard it said that where you are today is a collective of all of the choices that you've made in the past. And if you want to be someplace different tomorrow, make different choices. Choose different things and maybe become more, maybe not all embracing of change, but be more accepting of those changes that come your way. And rather than getting emotionally twisted and turned and knotted up, maybe take a different observational perspective. Move somewhere else along the circle and see it from a different perspective. It might change your emotional response, and it may also propel you into a place you've never been before, which could be where you'd really like to be.
Yes, I've heard that too, and I think there's some truth to that, but I also would sort of put out the caveat that there is a psychological process that has to happen with that, because again, it's very difficult just to try to be different or look at something differently mm-hmm. when you haven't processed your own belief systems. Why do you believe the way you believe? Why do you act the way that you act? Who are you in this relationship? Who are you in that relationship? Who are you with, in relationship to your parents? Who are you in relationship to your spouse or your friends? You will be someone different in each of those. And if you don't know who you are in all of these situations, it's very difficult to imagine who you would be in the face of change. And that is where we get stuck, because that's a terrifying place to be. We don't know who we are going to be on the other side of change, so it's easier just to not change.
Now, you keep referring to the psychological work. Where does the spiritual life come into this?
Well, I think a lot of times you really can't necessarily separate out your spiritual work from your psychological work.
So our language kind of gets in the way of this a little bit.
It does, and you know, there's work around that too. It's a lot of people even get confused with spiritual practice or spiritual work and religion,
mm-hmm.
and those are very different. And that's a whole other conversation
sure.
at another time. But
mm-hmm.
just to try to answer your question in a short time, that when you're working with your psychology, you're working with your psyche, who you are at the very core of your being. Some people call that soul, and some people call it, your God center. There's lots of words for it depending on what culture you come from.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't necessarily strip out your psychological processing, who you are at your core, any more than you can strip out who you are as a human being in relationship with everything else on the planet. That's more of a spiritual practice, when you're in relationship with other things in the planet. But it also has to do with, relationship with yourself.
Yeah.
There's a sense of spiritual work and spiritual practice in relationship with yourself. For example, a lot of people engage in a practice of yoga so that they develop what they would call a spiritual practice. So they're getting to know their body, their body movements, their muscular movements, their breathing, their respiratory, how their respiration is affected from different states.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a spiritual practice.
Yeah.
But we could also say that's somewhat of a psychological practice, because you're getting to know who you are in response to different situations. When I get scared, my respiration increases.
Yeah.
When I get angry, my muscles get tight. I breathe more shallower.
Mm.
So that is, they can go together, but at the same time, they're not necessarily one and the same thing.
Right. I want to ask you one final question before we wrap up. We just have about 30 seconds or so, and I apologize for only giving that much time. Matter of fact, I'll carry it over into the next segment. The question basically would be that you, I'm sure, could have done a lot of other things in your life in the first half century that you and I have lived here on the planet. However, you have chosen what you have chosen, and you are where you are today. Why this? Why now?
Well, I think the things that I have done in the past all led me to this particular spot or this particular landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I can't think of anything else that's more important for me in my life and how I want to leave this world than trying to engage in a conscious a process of consciousness, because I know that however much I understand about myself, I will put that back into the world.
Mm.
And maybe one little droplet of consciousness, from this human being will make a difference for the world. Not that it makes it necessarily a better place or a different place or what, but it will make a change in the world. And I'm hoping it will make a change in a conscious way, because it all boils down to relationships.
Absolutely.
How relational can I be before I die?
Yeah. And as we wrap up this segment of our program, I'm Richard Dugan. Lori Pye has been my guest. She is the director of the Institute for Cultural Change here on Tell Me Your Story. New paradigms for a new world, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next Saturday, be sure to go to the website, richarddugan.com. Listen to the after interview that is at the end of the audio file that this program will be a part of. And until next Saturday, love to law. And we continue with our program and with Lori Pye, my guest, who is with the Institute for Cultural Change. And we are talking about just that, about change, about movement in time and space, and how sometimes people want to go, they're trying to find a time machine to go back in time to correct that which they did that they don't like today, Lori, about themselves. And I think that there's a missing component they don't realize, and that is that if you go back, if you could go back and change that aspect of yourself that you don't like today, you wouldn't be the person you are today. You wouldn't be where you are today in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I think that's probably true as well, Richard. And but there's several thoughts that go with that. We can be like good scientists as well, mm-hmm. and track or trace a behavior back to where we can even sort of sniff out where it potentially first started. And in that case, that is a very important activity, because if you can discern the origin of when a behavior started, you can probably see where you developed a pattern that you engaged in throughout your entire life. And once you understand that, then it makes changing that pattern a little bit easier, because you understood why it was created. Mm. And the situation that created it may have saved your life then as a young child for you to endure what you were having to endure. But as an adult, it's become a hindrance. It's prevented you from becoming relational or self, you know, your self-understanding from being really fruitful. So you can change it. You can change it now. You don't have to wish that you could go back in time to change anything. But I think what you're saying is we do look back sometimes and say, "Gosh, I wish I had done something different in that situation. I wish I had dealt with that differently."
Yeah. And so then what we need to do is, rather than trying to go back in the fictional time machine of H.G. Wells, is learn the lessons of that event in the past so as to expand our consciousness and our awareness of self. And hopefully, if a similar experience comes along in the future, we will handle that differently. And then feel better about ourselves.
Yeah.
When you talk about psychology, spirituality, a lot of the more etheric and esoteric concepts that really we don't have a lot of hard evidence to support, especially when it comes to spirituality, in terms of this whole aspect of cultural change, everybody's coming from a different perspective and a different point of view. There's 6 billion. I don't know if there's 7 billion now.
Yeah.
I don't know how fast we're growing, but we're growing very fast. Different perspectives and ideas about it. And there are some that I really like, and then there are others that, like, I have no interest in, and then there are others that I want to have nothing to do with. Mm-hmm. And it's real interesting how we become so discriminating in our willingness to even listen to those ideas. We did a program not too long ago where I said, I'm not going to tell you where these people are from philosophically or religiously or spiritually. We're going to discuss the tenets of their faith, of their belief system. I'll tell you where they're from at the end of the program, because where they're from, the name is so charged energetically, negatively, that if I tell you now, you probably wouldn't stay and listen. And so when we want to learn more about, say, Buddhism, no problem. Zen, no real problem usually. The Muslim faith, oh, I don't know about that. That's kind of, I don't want to touch that.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't learning and expanding, as we were told as children, go to the library, read a book, and expand your horizons, broaden your horizons. isn't that hampering our ability to grow?
Well, to not engage and not be curious about other cultures, I think certainly is interfering with our widening of perspectives, which of course hinders our growth. But I want to be very careful that we don't just sort of put spirituality and psychology into the same mixing pot, because
okay.
they're really very, very different. And the Institute for Cultural Change doesn't have what a lot of organizations would call spiritual programs or spiritual practice or anything like that. It's really more of a educational activity and educational processes that we talk about, but looking at ourselves psychologically and looking at our psychological life. We don't, you know, that's the thing. We're living human beings, but how we live is where we cut the term psychology. It is one psyche to another, one psyche to the world, one psyche to, you know, our animals, one psyche to the plant world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's psychology. It's the study of the psyche. And so that's really what we're more engaged in. You know, people's spiritual practice or spiritual life is so personal. I wouldn't even begin to even go into that. It's not an area that, for one, I feel comfortable talking about on the radio, because I do think it's very much of a private thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a very important aspect of knowing who you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does your spirit need? But at the Institute of Cultural Change, we would ask it in a different way. It would be more along the lines of, what does your soul need? What does your soul need?
Huh. I know that as I have approached this marker in my life that I referred to at the beginning of the program,
mm-hmm.
I noticed that I began to become more, I'm not sure if the term is retrospective, maybe more observational, more thoughtful about what's going on around me, about spending time standing out on the hillside where I live, looking out at the valley to the north that is quiet, that is the wilderness, and just kind of standing there, not working to do anything, not trying to quiet the mind because there's effort involved in that, but just trying to stand there and sort of just be.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, this is interesting. Does this have anything to do with this marker that I'm heading towards? Or is there something else that's going on? And there are lots of things that affect us. I mean, we see the moon and it affects the tides. They've even shown how, I guess, it is actually affecting us psychologically as well as physically. And as it, you know, ebbs and flows, full moon to new moon and back again, and as it spins around the earth and so forth. So I'm wondering about those kinds of effects on us and our ability to change or to sort of accept change and deal with it in a more positive way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a loaded thought you had there. There's so many things that came to mind. And, you know, one of the things that you talk about that is reflection, and whether it's observational or just being quiet or just sort of being more you know, clued into your environment. But if you think about the soul's first habitual activity is reflection. So that's not something that's foreign to us unless we have completely avoided that all of our lives and created other activities like denial or defense mechanisms so that we've actually shut off our ability to reflect. But I think when we hit 45, 50, 55, those years are really crossroad turning points for the human being. And C.G. Jung talks about this a lot, this importance of the second half of life, that something happens psychological that really propels us to look more deeply into who we are. And that's really what a lot of his psychology was about. How are we to understand ourselves? We've gone through 45, 50 years of our lives, and how are we to make sense of the next 45 or 50 years? How are we to make meaning in these next 45 or 50 years? And more importantly, how are we to understand who we are? And so I think something definitely happens in these periods of you know, transition, 45, 50, 55 years of age, that we start to really get more serious about who we are.
Now, I've had interviews with people talking about cycles, both the cycles of the human being on a very physical and individual basis, moving up to cycles of civilization, to cycles of the planets and the universe. And so I then have to ask, in relation to change, is it change or just cycles?
Well, I'm not sure that I would make such a big distinction between those, because change can certainly be cyclical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes we take two steps forward and then we take a step back. The soul is not linear. There's not a linear movement in how the soul moves, any more than there's really a linear movement in how the brain is triggered or patterns of behavior get triggered. And, you know, the neurosciences have really come a long way in the last even 3 or 4 years, Richard. I mean, the neurosciences now actually do have proof for some of the things that we would have called metaphysics just 3 or 4 years ago. So we know that art, for example, or beauty or nature, we know being in nature, we know these things absolutely change things in the brain. They change chemical composition, they change patterning, they change how the cells are acting and reacting and are reforming, so that we know now the plasticity of the brain. We know that we can change the brain. So that's not metaphysical anymore.
Right.
It's not guesswork. It's not, quote unquote, you know, just spiritual, where we don't really know if that's grounded or not. We know it is now.
Mm-hmm.
It's spiritual, it's psychological, it's biological, it's physiological, it's neurological, it's mythological.
Yeah. I find it fascinating to talk to people in regards to the brain in particular, especially, of course, rewriting the pathways. And that, of course, comes through, you know, sort of that self-introspection and growing and learning more and experiencing more. I remember as a kid growing up telling people told me, especially when it came to alcohol, that, you know, if you drank too much, you know, you'd be killing off brain cells, and brain cells don't regenerate. And yet, I've been taught since then that the entire physical body, including the brain, regenerates brand new cells every 7 years on the average. And so I'm sitting here going, wait a minute, which is it?
Yeah.
And to that end, when you're talking about healthy versus damaged tissue and subsequent cells, what is it that causes, say, the skin to regenerate back to healthy for the most part? Maybe you occasionally get a scar, but still, it's healthy skin.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, a heart muscle doesn't do the same thing.
No,
and yet, their cells are cells.
Yeah. The cells are different. Like the,
yeah,
the what you refer to, the liver cells do rejuvenate every 7 years. Mm-hmm. But the lungs also can rejuvenate, but in a different time frame.
Mm-hmm.
We're still learning a lot about the heart and the brain. You know, we know that cells can reproduce and rejuvenate, but we're not quite sure as to the full extent yet, which is why there's hope for, you know, some brain diseases or brain injuries that those can be rehabilitated and that people can, you know, I've had several dear friends that had major strokes and have slowly come back to where they can walk and talk, and you know, the cognitive faculties are as sharp as ever, but the body motor skills took longer to come back. So, you know, all the millions and millions of cells in our body sort of have their own little brain and their own time frame, and we're still learning so much about just this human body.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing journey. You asked before why I do this. To me, the human psyche is just the most fascinating, you know, growing, living organism that I can think of. And I'm completely fascinated by not just how things and systems work in the natural world, but how this amazing human system works, because there's just so much potential in it.
Oh, yeah, there's no question. I just wish that I could carry that reflective and observational motif that I get into up on the hill down here when I'm driving along the 101 or I'm going across Mission Street or wherever it is, and I see what I term are the knuckleheads who are driving along and doing stupid things that are contrary to the laws and just common courtesy of fellow human beings. And I just like, you knucklehead, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, where'd that reflective guy go? I need him back, you know?
Yeah. And that's you're doing that, though. I mean, it's just, you know, being mindful of that reflective place. And it's not for every moment, though. I mean, when you're driving down the freeway to go into deep reflection, sometimes you could potentially lose your focus and have an accident. So you have to
become the knucklehead.
You know, discriminate about where you decide to engage in deep reflection.
Exactly. Well, then I become the knucklehead when I do that. yeah, that's not good. And don't listen to meditative tapes while driving either. I had someone that was starting to do that and realized she was starting to drift off, and she turned the thing off going, what in the world am I doing?
Don't do that again. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about, in terms of the impact of intention, mm-hmm. of a focused intention on a thing that isn't here yet, but certainly if it were to come, it would be change. So what about controlling, well, maybe not controlling or manipulating, but what's the word? Consciously bringing about change in your life, not the all-embracing, I love change, but this is the kind of change that I want, and focusing my intention on that.
Yeah, I think that's very important, because it's a focused energy, and it's an energy that the whole body recognizes and can go with. It doesn't mean it's going to happen in your time frame, and sometimes we get frustrated and we give up on that, and the next thing you know, we're hit over the head with it. But I think really what you're talking about is manifesting. You know, how do we manifest the change that we want?
Yes.
And I think in order to do that, the idea of focusing your intention on that certainly allows you to be more observant as to what's going on, not just in the body, because that's where it's going to start.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you get inklings, you know, in the body, a body sensation, a body feeling, you know, that gut feeling
mm-hmm.
about something before it even becomes conscious somewhere in the brain or the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit of a catch-up sometimes, it feels there. But I think it's a very important part of that process is where are you placing your intention? Because really what you're doing as a system in nature is you're saying, where am I placing my energy?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. This to me is, obviously we could talk for hours on all of these different
yeah.
subjects, and it's just fascinating. Love to have you back on the program again, and I want to thank you not only for participating in the program, but also for staying with us in the after interview here on Tell Me Your Story. And again, people can get in touch with you through the InstituteForCulturalChange.org. And there is, if you go to the homepage, scroll to the bottom, lower left-hand corner is an email address and a phone number where people can get in touch with you, right?
Right.
Great. Lori Pai, thank you so much for sharing with us, the director of the Institute for Cultural Change.org. Check her out. Check out the website and go to richarddugan.com. We have a link to her website as well as this audio interview where you can hear this whole segment that you're listening to now. And of course, if you're listening to it, you had to know that it was there in the first place. Lori, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Richard.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next Saturday at this same time, love to Lal.